From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Hurt stars in the new film Scandal, based on the Profumo sex scandal that shook up the British government in the early 60s. On today's Fresh Air, Hurt talks about his new film, and we look back on his starring roles in The Elephant Man and The Naked Civil Servant. Frederick Forsyth is the author of the spy thrillers The Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, The Dogs of War, and the new novel The Negotiator. Coming up, Forsyth tells us about some of the hazards of his profession. Boogie-woogie pianist Marsha Ball joins us on our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone looks back on the career of Bette Davis, the subject of a recent tribute by the Film Society of Lincoln Center. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The British actor John Hurt has given acclaimed performances as outcasts and extravagant personalities. He starred as the deformed John Merrick in the film The Elephant Man, and he played the flamboyant and defiant homosexual Quentin Crisp in The Naked Civil Servant. In the BBC series I, Claudius, he starred as the Emperor Caligula, and in Midnight Express he was a strung-out English junkie. John Hurt stars in the new film Scandal, which is based on the Profumo sex scandal that rocked the British government in the early 60s. John Profumo, the British war minister, resigned after the press reported his affair with good-time girl Christine Keeler. She was simultaneously having an affair with a Russian rumored to be a spy. Hurt plays Stephen Ward, a society doctor who took the young Keeler under his wing and groomed her to be a more refined party girl, worthy of the political and society leaders he introduced her to. When the scandal broke, Ward was arrested and accused of living on the earnings of prostitutes. John Hurt was urged by some of his colleagues not to take the role of Stephen Ward.
The reason for that, I think, is that we took quite a lot of flack from the establishment, who really closed ranks and would rather not have what I've come to call the poor old Jack syndrome, meaning Jack Profumo, to be dragged through it again. This, of course, was an attitude taken by people that had not read the script and certainly not seen the film. And I suppose it's quite understandable that they thought we'd be making some sort of salacious film, which, of course, was never the intention and not the result. And I think the attitude has changed somewhat since the film has come out.
Since you're playing a character that actually lived, did you go back and read articles and books on the Profumo scandal?
Yes, I did. I read what I thought was necessary. But basically a performance, I think, still comes from an imaginative exercise, really coming from the script. And the script writer, Michael Thomas, had done most of the research for me, in a sense.
The character that you play, Stephen Ward, is something of a hedonist and a sexual connoisseur. He loves to sketch naked women, to go to orgies, to match older men with young women. And I want to play a short clip from the film in which your character, Stephen Ward, is at one such party.
Right.
I have always had a preference for what the Americans call heavy petting. Well, it's something that I was studying over there at college in Missouri. But I adore the oh-so-painfully slow escalation of touch and caress. Tiny nibbling kisses, sigh of silk on milk-white flesh. I love the ache.
Monsieur?
Can go on for hours and hours.
Stephen, you're such a tease.
One of the interesting things about the character that you play is, in a way, he's all talk when it comes to sex. There's never any evidence in the movie that he ever indulges himself. Did you have to get into the psychology of that and understand how a character would be so interested in and absorbed in sex, yet never seem to have any himself, never care to?
I think he did have a certain amount. I don't think he was a particularly successful lover. Yes, I think his turn-on, if you like, was more in the talk about it and watching it and putting people into that position. Yes, there was definitely a great deal of the voyeur in him.
You always have a cigarette dangling from your lip in Scandal, and you make the character look like such an experienced smoker, the kind of smoker who could be doing anything while smoking. Are you an experienced smoker yourself?
I do smoke, yes. I have to confess that I do smoke. Not that I'm trying to put a spanner in the works of the American dream of utopia by the year 2000 and a smokeless society. But at the moment, I do smoke, yes.
John Hurt is my guest, and he stars in the new movie Scandal. You've played several roles of outcasts and extravagant personalities, the Elephant Man, the Naked Civil Servant. Do you feel like you have a special affinity with that kind of role?
It's never been designed on my part. I certainly can't deny that from, say, Caligula and I, Claudius, to Quentin Crisp, Naked Civil Servant, that these are not anything other than flamboyant people. I have played, of course, many other parts that are not in that area of flamboyance.
Do you ever see yourself that way? As being,
do I see myself?
Yeah,
that
as
way?
Being
no,
unusual or having any
extravagances. I certainly don't see myself as Caligula.
No. No, but
mind
I mean,
you, I have been offered Caligula 3 times, and that was the time that I played it, so I sometimes wonder what is in my personality that makes people think of me in that direction.
You play the Elephant Man, John Merrick. Well, let me explain who John Merrick was for our listeners who don't know. He was the man who became known as the Elephant Man, who was severely deformed, grotesquely deformed. You played him as someone who, although having a grotesque exterior, had a refined, elegant, artistic spirit. Was it written that way, or was that something you read into the character?
That's something that I felt it was. That's certainly what I felt, and I think that David Lynch felt the same thing, the director. Yes, I mean, the simple thesis of that film is that people are not what they seem to be according to their looks.
I'd like to play a short clip from this movie, which I think just illustrates this refinement of spirit that you have in the film. And I should say before we hear it that your character's mouth is deformed and his speech is slurred, so our listeners might have a little bit of trouble following the exact speech. But this is a scene where Anne Bancroft, as a great lady of the stage, comes and visits John Merrick and introduces herself, and he's very excited to meet someone of the theater.
Well, Mr. Treve tells me that you're in the theater. Do you live there?
Oh, no, Mr. Merrick, I just work there.
Well, it must be wonderful just to work there. It's beautiful.
You've never been?
I'm afraid not.
Oh, Mr. Merrick, you must go. The theater's the most beautiful place on earth. Of course, I am a bit partial. The theater is romance.
When you say romance, oh yes, at the end there's so much yearning in the voice that you communicate. I think it's a really beautiful moment in the film.
It is, yes. It was a wonderful script, I have to say. It was a wonderful script to play. And the Elephant Man, in a sense, embodies everything which is misunderstood in us all. And I think I feel that's probably why people feel such a great empathy for him.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the speech style that you developed for the character, a kind of high and airy voice and a constant, like, slurping. What position was your mouth in when you were underneath all the makeup and had to speak?
Well, it was fairly twisted because I had also gums over my teeth, which had a very peculiar kind of irregular protruding teeth of their own, so it developed in a sense. It was the whole voice came from instead of the Elephant Man having his own difficulties in speaking, I had my own difficulties with what was already in my mouth, and used it to advantage rather than letting it impede what I was trying to do.
In a way, your performance in The Elephant Man reminds me of Charles Laughton's performance in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, in the sense that I think they're both brilliant performances, yet the face and the voice of the actor in each is unrecognizable. Is it like working with a hand tied behind your back, knowing that your real face isn't visible and it will be harder to communicate facial expressions and you have to use a different voice than the one you're accustomed to using?
Well, that is true. I mean, Elephant Man, obviously, the voice was an enormous amount of my armory, as it were. And also, rather than using facial expression, I work quite a lot with a mirror, and almost in a sculpturesque way, understanding how to use my body or the inclination of the head in order to say something.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like working with a mask, in a sense. But the voice was obviously enormously important.
I want to bring up Charles Laughton again. He said something that is one of my favorite comments about acting. He once said that people don't know what they're like, and I think I can show them. I think it's a beautiful statement about acting. And I think really that the best acting is somehow about what it is to be human. And I wonder if you ever feel that way about acting.
Oh, I mean, you're talking about one of my favorite actors anyway. I think Charles Laughton was one of the greats. And I completely agree with that statement. It's perhaps an arrogant one, but I understand what he means.
And do you feel that you go about that pursuit in an intuitive way or in an intellectual one?
I think it's a mixture, really. Eventually, it's going to be intuitive. But obviously, one uses one's intelligence as much as possible in order to feed the computer of the mind, if you like, with the right stuff, in order to be intuitive.
For the movie The Elephant Man, you had to spend hours getting makeup applied every day. It must be terribly boring to have to endure that.
Well, you'd think so, certainly, to just have it mentioned like that. But in actual fact, I had to take a real participant's part in it. It was a seven-hour makeup, and everything had to be watched. It was prosthetic makeup, and it was quite early days for that sort of prosthetics. People are much more proficient these days. Probably wouldn't have taken quite so long now. But at that time, if it was a millimetre out, we'd have to start again. So, I mean, there was the makeup man, his assistant, and myself, and we were all taking a very concentrated part in the application of the makeup. So, actually, 7 hours passed much more quickly than you'd think.
When you looked at yourself in the mirror with all the Elephant Man makeup on, did you recognize yourself?
It's very hard to say, isn't it? I mean, I was looking at myself from the other side of my eyes, if you like. I was looking, hopefully, as John Merrick in the mirror, and trying to find a way of, at the same time, as technically be able to get over what I wanted to say. It's very hard to describe that one, I must admit.
Did the experience end up giving you any different feeling about your real voice and real face?
I think certainly that one felt an enormous gratitude that one of us had at least some sort of attraction. It was quite a humbling experience to realize, to be in the skin of that poor man, understanding how difficult life was, and at the same time, a kind of sanctity that allowed him to be what he was at the same underneath it all.
As I mentioned before, I thought your performance in it was really brilliant. I was wondering if, when you took on the role, if you were ever concerned that people would just see it as a lot of really good makeup, special effects, and not really see the performance behind the makeup.
That would have been disaster, I must say. But I don't think I allowed myself to think that at the time. I couldn't possibly allow myself to think negatively about it.
Mm-hmm. How did you get the role, by the way?
Well, it was a very high compliment, I must say. It came from David Lynch, who particularly wanted me to play it on the grounds that he'd seen two things before. One was called The Naked Civil Servant, where I played an effeminate homosexual exhibitionist called Quentin Crisp. And the other thing he'd seen was Caligula and I, Claudius, both of which, he said, he felt that the actor got completely lost and he believed that that character was alive for him in front of him, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the highest compliment he could have paid me. And he needed an actor like that, he felt, for The Elephant Man. So that's how it came about.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more about your acting career, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is actor John Hurt, and he stars in the new film Scandal. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor John Hurt is my guest. He's played such roles as the Elephant Man, Caligula in I, Claudius, and Quentin Crisp in The Naked Civil Servant. He's also appeared in 1984, Midnight Express, and A Man for All Seasons. Hurt is now starring in Scandal, the new film about the Profumo Affair, a British sex scandal of the early 60s. Let me ask you about The Naked Civil Servant, where you played Quentin Crisp, as you just described, who was a very flamboyant homosexual who wore makeup and dyed his hair back when being homosexual was still officially illegal in England. How were you cast in that role?
That's an interesting story, too. Philip Mackie, who wrote the piece, I knew him quite well, and I was in a London actors' club, and we were just mucking about, really. One evening, and it occurred to him that at that moment that I'd be right for Quentin Crisp, which he was trying to get off the ground as a film. And that's how that started. 3 years later, we made it, finally, having been turned down by the BBC and having been turned down by Wardour Street, which is the British film industry equivalent of Hollywood, really. And we made it for Thames Television. 90-minute film.
Some heterosexual actors are reluctant to take on homosexual roles for fear, A, that some people might assume that they're homosexual and they might be fearful of being typed as that, or B, they might think that homosexuals will think that they're inauthentic in the role. Did you have any fears about taking on such a role?
I never had any qualms at all. It was a brilliant script for a start.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have the slightest qualms. I had many people actually suggest to me that I shouldn't play it for those reasons. They said Peter Finch played Oscar Wilde and he didn't work for 3 years after that, and Dirk Bogarde didn't work for some time after he'd made a film called Victim in the 60s. But it seemed to me that the piece was about the tenderness of the individual as opposed to the cruelty of the crowd, in a sense, and it was a superb piece of writing. And it really did not occur to me to turn it down.
Let me play a very brief clip from the movie, and this is John Hurt starring as Quentin Crisp.
I am an effeminate homosexual. I want to win the admiration. I want to be found desirable by a great, dark man.
Yes.
But what proof have I that I'm desired? No great, dark man is going to come up to me and say, Quentin, I adore you, your eyes are like stars and your lips are like roses.
No.
A 10-shilling note is proof. A proof I understand.
Your voice reminds me a little of Katharine Hepburn there.
Well, I mean, the thing about Quentin, the way in which he speaks, is that he knows what he's going to say, how he's going to say it, and when he's going to say it. So that it's very deliberate. Very deliberate and quite a high camp kind of delivery.
I've met Quentin Crisp and read one of his books, and he strikes me as someone who really lives life as theater. And I've met a lot of people like that, who kind of dress for the part that they've decided to play, and really, add a certain theater to life as well. And I wonder if you could relate to that, and if you've ever been like that yourself.
No, I would say that I was the absolute opposite of that, really. I know exactly what you mean. Quentin does. I mean, he's decided to live his life theatrically.
Mm-hmm. And he's very good at it.
And extremely good at it, yes. A highly intelligent man, very good writer, too. And also lives according to his philosophy, which is extremely generous and patient philosophy, I might say. But no, I would say that I was quite the opposite of that. My personal life is not a theatrical one, really.
So your theatrical stuff is confined to the stage?
I would have thought so, yes. You know, unless you catch me in a flamboyant mood.
Right. Are you invigorated or exhausted by people who do see their own life as theater?
Oh, it depends. I mean...
Depends on the person.
It depends entirely on whether they ought to see their life as theatrical.
Have you ever auditioned for a role that you realized totally didn't suit you?
Yes, I have. Yes. Gandhi.
What didn't suit you about that?
Well, I mean, at one stage, Richard Attenborough wanted me to play Gandhi. And I met with people in Hollywood at the Lingerie, rather special restaurant in Los Angeles. We raised glasses of champagne to the project and so on. All of this, of course, was subject to a makeup test. And when I got back to England, I did the makeup test, and I went in there and they put brown all over my face and scraped my hair back, put me in what I could only call as a rather large diaper, and sent me on in front of the camera to do a bit of Indian acting, you know? So I did a bit of that. And when we looked at the rushes the next day, the dailies, we looked at each other afterwards, and Dickie said, "Well, I don't think it's going to be possible to you, John." I said, "Certainly not, Dickie. It is. It looks like a Welsh rugby football player in a nappy." So, yes, I don't think that was. I don't think that was would have made a particularly good performance somehow.
Were you terribly disappointed?
Not in a sense, no, because I didn't. Though it's a part that if it came your way, you wouldn't dream of turning down. But I do think you had to have Indian blood to play it, and I think Ben Kingsley was the perfect choice.
Have you ever found out too late that you were wrong for a role? Did you ever accept one that you were sorry you did?
I've accepted the odd thing that I'm sorry I did, but not because I felt that I was wrong for it.
What was the reason then you were sorry?
Maybe other things that... arguments with perhaps with directors or something like that.
Would you mention such
or
a role?
Or the way in which they were looking at it that I disagreed with and things of that nature, yeah.
Would you care to mention the role, or would you rather not?
No, I'd rather not.
Okay. Actor John Hurt is my guest, and he starred in The Elephant Man, I, Claudius, The Naked Civil Servant, 1984. Your father was a clergyman. Oh, and he stars in the new movie Scandal. Your father was a clergyman. Did you have a religious...
Yes, that's right. He still is.
Oh, good, okay. Did you have a religious upbringing?
He's 85 years old, and he's still working. Yes, I did. I had a very religious upbringing. As a Church of England clergyman, which is Episcopalian here. That's how I was brought up.
When you were young, were you held back from doing certain things that the other kids did because your father was a clergyman?
Yes, certain things. Certain things. My parents, for instance, I was never allowed to go to Saturday morning pictures, you know, things like that for children. They considered that to be a bit common. And also by the very nature of being a clergyman's son, people tend to put you slightly apart, which is... tend to live a life at some stages as being people being suspicious of you and puts you rather on a, I don't mean lonely particularly, but it does tend to put you apart.
If you didn't get to go to the movies when you were young, what interested you in acting?
Oh, acting.
Right. Where were you
Without
exposed
question.
To it?
Not looking, but doing.
So yeah. Had you seen a lot of acting before you started getting interested in it yourself?
Oh, I'd seen quite a bit, yes, because my parents were lovers of the theatre, and I used to go to the local repertory company quite frequently. But, I mean, what really gave me the passion for it was actually first appearing on a stage in a school play when I was 9 years old, I think, mm-hmm. And I was in the school play every year from that time.
You went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Eventually, yes.
Did you see yourself in the tradition of Gielgud? Did you want to be a great stage actor?
Oh, my God. I mean, that's one of the things that absolutely terrified me when I went to the Royal Academy. I thought everybody was going to be like Olivier and Gielgud. I found it very daunting, very frightening, because I had such huge admiration for them. I soon found out when I got to the Royal Academy that they were not all like that, however. They were... terrific inspiration, but I never thought that I would be, as it were, in the same area of perfection.
Do you think that the British tradition of acting is much different than the American? And I'm wondering if you relate to the style of American actors like Robert De Niro.
Oh, I certainly do, yes. I think Robert De Niro is a brilliant screen actor. But then I wouldn't say that Robert De Niro is peculiarly unlike the British approach, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or Robert Duvall, for that matter.
What would you consider the British approach to be?
Well, I would say that it's a gross generalization, but the British tradition basically is to go to the character. And the Hollywood tradition, shall we say, is basically to take the character to the performer.
Would you explain that?
The British tradition is to go to the character, right? So you become the character.
Mm-hmm.
The Hollywood tradition is to make the character become yourself. You take the... So you use your own personality, as in Cary Grant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Alec Guinness, for instance, will go to the character and he will become that character. And I would say that if there was... And I think that Robert De Niro does that.
Let's look at your new movie, Scandal. How did you try to become the character?
By imagining to be that character.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Basically. Obviously, one takes... You research as much as you can. You gather all the information you can and put it in the think tank and let it ferment, as it were. And finally, things start making themselves clear. But it's an imaginative exercise in the end.
Was it hard for you to make the jump from theater to screen in England?
From theater to screen?
Mm-hmm.
Not really. No, I was doing a play at the time that Fred Zinnemann was casting Man for All Seasons, and he saw me doing something there, and I got Man for All Seasons from doing a play. So they've always been kind of interlinked, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me ask you a Mel Brooks question. He has cast you in cameos in at least two of his movies, Spaceballs.
Oh, I know. He's miserable. He's miserable. He keeps getting me to come over and do things for... I'd just like you to do this, John. I mean, it's just a favor. There's no money in it, but, just come over and do me a favor. And I fall for it every time, so I come over here and play Jesus Christ in...
History of the World, Part One,
and then I reenacted the alien, rather painful birth in Spaceballs. And he got me for nothing both times. He'll probably get me a third time for nothing. You never know. He's very clever at it.
Well, he produced The Elephant Man, but where does your relationship date back to?
Well, that's what it does date back to. He was a brilliant producer of that. He was terrific. He was the executive producer, and without him, I don't think David Lynch would have had that break. And he was tremendously helpful in getting a difficult film like that through the net.
Do you enjoy doing comedy?
Love it, yes. Don't do enough of it, though.
Let me ask you, there was a period in America, I guess it was in the early 80s, when you were becoming better known, William Hurt was starting his career, and John Hurd was starting his career. And
yeah.
I think a lot of people got all the names confused, and the faces weren't all that familiar yet. Were you aware of that?
Oh, definitely, yes. I think it's even in Trivial Pursuits, isn't it?
Oh, is it? I think so.
I've never played... The original Trivial Pursuits, I think it said, who played the Elephant Man, William Hurt, John Hurd, or John Hurt? Yeah.
So did that ever have any direct effects on you, the confusion?
I don't know. I don't think it's had any direct effect, no. But I do know people will sometimes come and congratulate me for something William's done, and William's told me that he's had the same thing vice versa.
Is this the kind of problem that you run into when you're so good that you really do lose yourself in a role, that people see the role and they don't necessarily connect it to the next performance? Because you change.
Well, it could be. It could be. Yes, I hope that's the case.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you indeed.
John Hurt stars in the new film Scandal, which is about the British sex scandal, the Profumo Affair of the early 1960s. He's also starred in 1984, The Elephant Man, The Naked Civil Servant, and I, Claudius. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Alice Walker, who's best known for The Color Purple. She has a new novel called The Temple of My Familiar. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The heroes in Frederick Forsyth's spy thrillers often go undercover to get the information they need. Frederick Forsyth does that too. Coming up, the author of The Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, The Dogs of War, and The Fourth Protocol tells us about talking to spies, getting caught by illegal arms dealers, and being awakened by the sound of gunfire. Also, pianist and singer Marshall Ball plays Boogie Woogie in our weekly performance spot. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone examines the on- and off-screen legacy of actress Bette Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Problems with the space shuttle Atlantis will delay the launch until Monday at the earliest. NPR's Richard Harris has the latest.
Engineers are investigating two problems with the space shuttle. One involves a pump in one of the main engines. This pump provides coolant to prevent the nozzle from melting during liftoff. NASA officials say they will spend tomorrow figuring out whether that problem is with the pump itself or with its wiring. The second problem was spotted only during a closed-circuit television replay of the launch preparations. Officials noticed a vapor cloud leaking unexpectedly from a line that connects the shuttle to its giant external tank. Engineers aren't yet sure whether the two problems are related. NASA officials also don't know how long it will take to repair them. They say, given the best possible scenario, they will be ready to go Monday. But repairs could take more than a week. NASA has until May 28th to launch Atlantis, which is carrying the Magellan space probe toward Venus. This is Richard Harris reporting from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
The United States and Japan have agreed to jointly produce an advanced version of the F-16 fighter jet. President Bush said today U.S. firms will perform 40% of the development and production of the new FSX fighter, and that Japan has agreed to U.S. request for protection of sensitive codes used for the plane's computers. The FSX deal was originally negotiated by the Reagan administration last year, but came under fire from Capitol Hill for being too favorable to Japanese interests. The president says the new fighter will not cost the American taxpayer. In Frankfurt, West Germany today, prosecuting attorneys presented closing arguments in the trial of confessed TWA hijacker Mohamed Hamadi. Deirdre Berger has details.
Nearly a year after the trial began, the prosecution today recommended that Mohamed Hamadi receive a life sentence. Capital punishment is outlawed in West Germany. Prosecuting attorneys said Hamadi was at least an accomplice in the murder of U.S. Navy diver Robert Steedham, even if it cannot be proved he pulled the trigger. The young Navy diver was killed during the hijacking of a TWA jet to Beirut in 1985. Hamadi admits he helped hijack the airplane, but contests his guilt in the murder. There was conflicting testimony during the trial about the shooting, for which there were no eyewitnesses. In addition to murder, Hamadi is charged with numerous counts of bodily injury and the smuggling of explosives. The defense will deliver its arguments next week, and a judgment is expected in mid-May. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting.
Panama's foreign minister told the United Nations Security Council today that the United States is planning to disrupt public order in Panama. Jorge Ritter said the U.S. has plans to interfere in the Panamanian electoral process. American Ambassador Thomas Pickering denied the charges, and he accused the Panamanian government of systematic fraud in the scheduled May 7th election. Former U.S. Presidents Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter will be among a group of international observers for the Panamanian elections. Chinese students can't count on U.S. support in their demands for democracy until it's clear what they want. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that democracy is defined in a lot of different ways when he was asked about pro-democracy protests in Beijing. China's campuses are reported to be quiet today, but students say they'll take to the streets again if the government backs out of its promised negotiations. Yesterday, government leaders agreed to talks after students led tens of thousands of people in a pro-democracy march in Beijing. For the second straight month, there was a drop in the government's index of leading economic indicators. The index, the government's main forecasting gauge of economic growth, dropped 0.7% in March, its biggest fall since July. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose less than a point today to close at 2418.81. Advances led declines on volume of 159 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The annual New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival is now underway, and one of the featured performers will be Marsha Ball, a boogie-woogie piano player from Austin, Texas. Today she joins us on our weekly performance spot. Marsha grew up in southern Louisiana. Her grandmother played ragtime piano, and her aunt played cocktail music, but it was the stride piano players in New Orleans who really influenced Marsha's style. The first song she's going to play was written by Leroy Parnell from Austin and Chris Moore. It's called Red Hot.
1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, baby, I'm a red hot. Yes, baby, I'm a red hot. Oh, honey, I can't stop. I can't stop thinking about you. My temperature just ain't the same since I felt your burning flame. Yes, baby, I'm a red hot. Yeah, honey, I'm a red hot. I can't stop thinking about you. First time I saw you walk by, I went off like a rocket on the 4th of July. Yes, baby, I'm a red hot. Oh, honey, I'm a red hot. I can't stop thinking about you. Don't you go and dial that 911 number for me. I'm just like a house on fire. Your love is what I need. Oh, baby, I'm red hot. Yes, baby, I'm a red hot.
I think if you grow up in Louisiana, you have more than the typical percentage of water in your chemical makeup. And as a result, you're drawn to water. And this next song happened because I was following the water, as I always do, along the Gulf Coast, and happened to be in Mobile, standing on that beautiful bay one day, and I thought, how long has it been since somebody wrote a song about this place? And so I wrote this song called Mobile.
Well, I found myself in a cold, cold city, looking out the windows of a bar. I had the snow piled up on the sidewalk and the big streets full of cars. I wonder what happened to this old girl. What mysterious turning of the wheel took a good wife and had a happy life, put her so far from Mobile. Mobile, by the beautiful bay. Mobile, why did I ever go away? Oh, how I miss my Alabama home. It's a far cry from this place, but I followed a man. He had promises grand and a very handsome face. I left my loving husband behind. I thought life owed me more.
take me back. I crawled here on my knees to Mobile by the beautiful bay. Mobile, why did I ever go away? Mobile, I'm coming back someday.
Marshall Ball's latest album, Gator Rhythms, is on the Rounder record label. This is Fresh Air. Frederick Forsyth is one of the world's best-selling spy novelists. His books include The Day of the Jackal, The Odessa File, The Dogs of War, and The Fourth Protocol. His new thriller is called The Negotiator. The main character, Quinn, is the world's best hostage negotiator. He's called in out of retirement when the son of the President of the United States is kidnapped. The kidnapping occurs on the eve of the signing of a major disarmament treaty between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The action takes place in the early 1990s, when Glasnost has been in place for a few years. Forsyth told me that in the era of Glasnost, he's had to rethink who the bad guys are.
The thriller writers have, for a long time now, been able to use the Cold War as a backdrop, and the bad guys are always the KGB. Nobody argued, you know, with how nasty the KGB was, etc. I don't think the KGB is necessarily changing, but I do think the public perception in the West is going to be that Gorb is a nice guy. Well, actually, he's not a pussycat. He's a tough operator, but you know, at least we're getting on better with him than we ever could with Andropov or Brezhnev. And therefore, slagging off the Soviet Union may be something of the past. For popular writers, therefore, it may be a question of looking out, yeah, for new bad guys. And actually, in this new book, I have used the ultra-right as the bad guys this time.
No, you mentioned Gorbachev. He's actually a character in your book.
Yeah, I bring him in as himself and Margaret Thatcher. But the American president is fictional. John J. Cormack does not exist, of course.
Are there any legal considerations when you bring in a real character, even someone of the stature of Thatcher or Gorbachev?
Well, I've done it before. Charles de Gaulle featured, obviously, in Day of the Jackal, and it's perfectly feasible to do it. You don't have to ask permission. When a person is a public figure, they've run for public office, they're hardly shrinking violets. Providing you don't libel them or defame them, there's nothing they can really do about it. And if you're going to put in a president as a kind of a walk-on figure, I would never make a main central character somebody like President Bush. That's why I have a President Cormack, who is fictional, because he's a much bigger role. But where one has a walk-on, like 10-minute cameo, there's no harm in using the real person. The only time I really slagged somebody off badly, who was real, was Edward Rushman, the Nazi, in The Odessa File, because I took the view that if he wanted to come back from Argentina and sue me, he was welcome, because they were going to pick him up for war crimes anyway. So.
That's very clever, actually.
So he didn't show, needless to say.
I think readers always assume that any writer of espionage fiction knows people on the inside of the CIA and MI5. Do you have contacts inside?
Well, you know, one knows the odd chap who perhaps once might have worked at Langley.
Well, that's vague enough. I guess you have to come up with good vague answers to give to when people ask you that.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things about writing this kind of stuff is that I can't get it unless people will talk to me. And talk to me off the record and talk to me about stuff that maybe has never appeared before in books. And they'll only do that if they're absolutely certain I'm not going to blow them away later. So, yes, I do have very good contacts, but I never mention who they are.
I want to ask you a few questions about your work before you started writing fiction. At the age of 17, you left home to be a bullfighter in Spain, which I thought was a pretty unusual fantasy. How far did you get, and why did you have that aspiration?
Well, first of all, not very far. My parents discovered and came down a bit sharpish. I had read a book called Death in the Afternoon by Ernest Hemingway, which was a classic. And I never fought a bull because, one, they're very, very expensive animals. And the kids just used to sign on and pay a little fee to this gimpy old matador who'd taken one horn too many, and he used to teach us the cape work, and it was fun. It was the spring of 56, a very innocent age.
Now, you became a journalist, worked as a journalist for over 10 years.
12 years, yeah.
Uh-huh. Who did you write for?
I started with a provincial newspaper. I didn't get out of the country for 3 years. Then I joined Reuters, the international news agency, and they sent me all over Paris. Actually, Paris, you see, when the OAS were trying to kill Charles de Gaulle, they gave me the seed of the idea for the Day of the Jackal.
Mm-hmm.
And then East Germany. I ran East Germany in the days when it really was fraught. You know, the tanks were gun to gun, muzzle to muzzle on Checkpoint Charlie. We thought maybe the Third World War would start there. And that was good fun.
You were stationed in East Germany for a while, not far from the Berlin Wall.
No, it was close to the Berlin Wall. I could hear the machine guns at night when they used to cut down the guys trying to get over the wall.
How did that affect the fiction that you later wrote?
Well, my time in Germany gave me the idea of the Nazi story, the Odessa. I first heard of the Odessa while I was in Germany, this ex-SS organization. And that gave me the idea years later. See, I store things up like a squirrel. I get little bits of information. I shove them away. I may not use them for years, but they're there somewhere. And I stored it up until eventually, 1971, I wrote the Odessa file.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were stationed in Africa for a while as a journalist.
Yeah.
And you covered the Biafran War
in
the late 60s.
Yeah.
But I think you got into a big dispute about your coverage of
the BBC. I'd left Reuters, you see, and joined the BBC, and up came the Biafra War. So they said, you know, would you go and cover the rebel side for us? And I said, I do Europe, remember? Europe and the Middle East. I don't do Africa, Black Africa. They said, well, go on. It's only going to last 10 days. So 2.5 years later, I came back. It was a long war. But I did, in the meantime, quit because I just felt they didn't want to cover it. The establishment didn't want to know what was going on down there. They were more interested in Vietnam. It was a nice American snafu.
How did you switch from journalism to fiction writing?
Fluke, coincidence. I came back in late December 1969, broke, tagged, several black marks against me. I had time on my hands, no commission, no work, no apartment, no car. I was crashing down on the settee of a friend in a friend's apartment. I thought, I've got time to kill, I might as well write this story. The Jackal, the assassin who tried to kill Charles de Gaulle. And so I wrote it, I dashed it off in 35 days, and then I just hawked it around town, and somebody bought it. And to my great amazement, instead of making $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, whatever, it became a big one. So it seemed the place to go. Obviously, I was going to be paid more to write fiction than ever writing facts.
Straighten out something for me. I read that in, I think it was 1978, the London Times accused you of raising funds to hire a mercenary army to oust a dictator in Equatorial Guinea. And this was to provide a homeland for displaced Biafrans. And they said that you had raised $200,000 in ammunition, supplies, and salaries for mercenaries, and implied that this might have been for research in how to fund a coup, research that you needed to write a novel.
Hell of a research, isn't it?
So what's the story with it?
The story is that's what they printed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great story. I loved it. Sold a lot of copies, too. But as to how I really researched the dogs of war, no, it's a nice idea, but it wasn't that complicated. I did move around the arms trafficking business. I did move around mercenaries. I needed it for the book, but the rest's a nice story.
How do you move around a secret world like that?
With great difficulty and very carefully, in my case. And yeah, I got my head blown off on that one.
How?
Well, the arms traffickers were rather dangerous guys, and they all had bodyguards. And I got in by posing as a South African, which explained how I spoke German but with an accent. And so I was attending conferences that purported to be about buying a package of weapons to find out how it was done. How end-user certificates were forged, how illegal arms shipments, you know, got to terrorists and mercenaries and other people. And that was fine, except that one particular day, one of these arms dealers was driving past a bookstore and a book had fallen over and on the back cover was my face. And
gosh.
Whoops-a-daisy. So I left Hamburg in about 14 minutes flat. It was just my bad luck. They launched the Day of the Jackal German edition while I was there. And there was this big display and, you know, it didn't mean anything to this guy. His car stopped on a red light. He was sitting behind the glass staring across the sidewalk at this big window display. And someone sort of came and nudged a book and it fell over. And there was the South African who was dealing with him over an arms purchase, staring at him. And he realized it was an investigative reporter. He nearly went bananas.
Well, was that the last time that you went undercover, so to speak, to research a story?
Yeah, I have occasionally offered somebody a name that wasn't entirely my own. But only bad guys, I assure you, only bad guys.
Frederick Forsyth's new spy novel is The Negotiator. It's published by Bantam Books. This is Fresh Air. Time to find out what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. There is a ceasefire in effect, finally, at last, in Beirut, in Lebanon. And NPR's John Hockenberry has sent along parts of conversations he's had with refugees who've been evacuated from that civil war to Cyprus. Also, we'll learn about Sergeant Barry Sadler, who was a big hit with a record in the 60s called The Ballad of the Green Berets. Sergeant Barry Sadler has been a mercenary and an author of war novels, and this past year he was shot in the head in Guatemala. He's now in a hospital in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And a conflict here in Washington between ducks and catfish.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last Monday, the Film Society of Lincoln Center honored one of America's great actresses, Bette Davis. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, was there and has these impressions.
Bette Davis has survived a stroke and a mastectomy. She's 81, and when the Lincoln Center Film Society decided to honor her with a gala tribute, she said it was about time. Thousands flocked to see her. The moussed coiffures were high, and there was a sea of black ties. When Davis appeared in a clinging sequined gown, the crowd went wild. Then the lights dimmed for a screening of clips, and we had a chance to assess her power. From the beginning of her career, she is having fun. She loves the attention of cameras and concocts flashy performances to hold them. The huge eyes look askance and the whites flash. Cigarettes dart in and out of her mouth. The shoulders sway, the hips bob, the hands nervously drum the hips. Her tongue slices the English language into unique rhythms. Listen to this stab in All About Eve.
Yeah, so that was the first and last...
Don't let me kill the point. There isn't a story for grown-ups.
You've heard it. About the time I looked through the wrong end of the camera finder.
Remind me to tell you about the time I looked into the heart of an artichoke. I'd like to hear it. Some snowy night in front of the fire.
And yet Davis is not vain. Compare her to some contemporaries. Claudette Colbert cannot stop flirting. Joan Crawford goes into mortal combat with the aging process. Katharine Hepburn tries unconvincingly to cloak her vanity behind the bluster that she's above petty human traits. Davis is never above being human. In all of her films, she presents a scrapbook of Freudian cases. The Hollywood powers didn't at first know what to do with her, although they saw that her energy and intelligence were a box office draw. They weren't adventurous enough to show a powerful woman serving herself and the world well, so they made her riotously destructive. Remember her in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
Oh, you're trying to help, Blanche. What are you planning to do with me when you've sold the house? What you have in mind, some nice little place where they could look after me?
The Davis persona cuts to shreds the fantasy of women as kinder than men, but she sometimes has to depict false emotions. She's too pitiless and shrill on occasion, and in several Weepers, where she plays against type, her parts are mired in sticky sentiment. She pulls off the scenes in Dark Victory, where her character chooses to die alone, but the pointless self-sacrifice, which underscores old-fashioned ideas about female virtue, lacks emotional truth. Rarely did Davis get parts as complex and credible as Margot Channing, the central figure in All About Eve. This is a woman who is neither gargoyle nor saint, and whose ambitiousness and vulnerability Davis reveals with startling originality. Boldness and courage keep marking her performances. In The Wails of August, where she looks very old and frail, she offers close-ups not only on her own condition, but human mortality. At the tribute, Geraldine Fitzgerald told an anecdote about herself and Davis traveling across country. They are pals on the road. Walking in New Mexico, they dish the men at Warner Brothers, and Davis, learning that Fitzgerald has never slept with the actor George Brent, quips, "Well, you're the only woman there who hasn't." Unfortunately, Davis never got to make a movie where she could show this comradely girlfriend side. But her violent screen vixens, her off-camera challenges to studio bosses, and her unimpeded belief in her own talent have helped stamp out the onerous specter of the nice girl. Davis is an inspiration to women to seize their time and all their opportunities.
Laura Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, on The Fireline, with Stephen Pine. He's written a first-hand account of his 15 years fighting forest fires at Grand Canyon National Park, years filled with isolation, physical hardship, physical danger, and stunning natural beauty. Director Louis Malle's first film featured a soundtrack by Miles Davis. That soundtrack has just been reissued, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will have a review. And television critic David Bianculli will review Cops, the new series that follows real-life police on their rounds. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.